Welcome to the Real Estate Show, sponsored by Capital Square Realty Advisors. We are thrilled to have world-class economist Dr. Peter Linneman on the show. Dr. Linneman will discuss multifamily investing and his conclusion that we are living in, quote, the golden age of multifamily investing. In a moment, Dr. Linneman will describe the science behind Capital Square's strategy of investing in suburban apartments in the Southeast in Texas.
Welcome to Dr. Linneman. For over 40 years, Dr. Peter Linneman's unique blend of scholarly rigor and practical business insight has won him accolades from around the world. My firm, Capital Square, engaged Dr. Linneman to study the economic and demographic data before launching the apartment REIT, and we'll discuss his findings shortly. It's a great honor to have Dr. Linneman on the Real Estate Show. Welcome.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here.
We enjoy the opportunity to pick your brain a little bit. Well, you prepared a white paper for Capital Square entitled The Golden Age of Multifamily Real Estate Investing. Yeah. And yes, this is the golden age of multifamily investing. And let's discuss why. Dr. Linneman, you emphasized a number of attributes in the white paper that favor multifamily investment. If you would, please educate our audience on the multifamily sector.
Well, there's a myriad of things that make it attractive. I might start out by saying one of the things we've done, we looked at the return performance of various property sectors over both three-year hold periods and 10-year hold periods. And one of the things we found is that multifamily on an unlevered basis performs better than the other sectors, at least historically, over these hold periods. And I think that leads into why. If you think about where value and performance comes from, it's a combination of rent and occupancy and stability capital flows. So if you think about the rent and occupancy, one of the nice things about multifamily, particularly what I would call traditional suburban garden as opposed to urban core high rise, is that it's a relatively simple product to build. It doesn't have a very long lead time, so that when things get difficult, the supply pipeline shrinks pretty quickly. That's one thing. And then as demand rebounds, it rebounds into a supply that's not crazy. The second is that there are good fundamentals in terms of demographics. And while the peak of demographics is basically a little behind us, the next 10, 12 years looking forward, you have almost the same number of new 20-year-olds. I'm talking about young renters, and they work their way through the pipeline as at the peak. So you have a good fundamental. This is not like after the baby boom, where when we aged, behind us was a baby bust. Here there's stability. That's another good thing. Third is that we find that over long time periods, as the employment grows, as the unemployment rate declines, as GDP grows, vacancy in apartments go down, which is to say, not terribly surprising, that when people have jobs, they rent apartments. Yes, they also buy homes, but they also rent apartments. And it is not necessary that apartments do badly when single family does well. People sometimes make that mistake of thinking if single family is doing well, multifamily must do poorly. But if you think about it, when Volkswagen's doing well, probably Ford, GM, and the other auto manufacturers are doing well. And when Ford is really doing badly, probably Volkswagen's doing badly. And the same thing here. They're relying on the same fundamentals of income and people needing a place to live. And then you switch to the capital market side. And the thing that multifamily has that no other sector has is Fannie and Freddie sitting there as massive lenders. So yes, you have life companies, just like any other sector. Yes, you have banks like any other sector. Yes, you have CMBS like any other sector. And in addition to that, you have Fannie, Freddie, and HUD sitting there behind. What that means is a much deeper capital pool and a much more stable flow of capital. And in research, where we pretty carefully statistically looked at it, and a big driver of values beyond rent and occupancy is capital availability, capital flow. And multifamily has uniquely, because of the presence of Freddie, Fannie, and HUD, stability and flow. That's a quick. Now, then there's why the golden age. That's why it's a good sector. Why the golden age? If you look historically, and history doesn't always repeat itself, but if you look historically, cap rates, the yield entering on an existing stabilized apartment relative to 10-year treasury rates might be about 200 to 250 basis points, something in that order. That's been more or less normal. And that's what's generated that historic performance I talked about, which is about a 9.5% unlevered annual return on a 10-year hold. Well, if you look at today, as you know, 10-year treasury is like, I don't know what it is today, 1.25%.
Thereabouts.
And cap rates are, and what, 4 to 5.5%, depending on the product and market. And yes, you could find a 3 cap in Santa Monica or Manhattan somewhere. But in general, which is what the comparison is all about, let's just say, what would you say, Louis, a 4.5 cap for something like 4.25 cap? Is that fair?
Historically, for Capital Square, yes.
So what that means is you've got a much wider spread over Treasury. Doesn't sound like a lot, but you've got a much wider spread of 300 basis points rather than 200 basis points. And what that means is more cash flow, right? More cash flow annually, and also much better coverage. And the coverage is important, as you know, because of risk, right? It reduces the risk you get squeezed. So you can borrow, you can still get good cash flow, you don't get squeezed on your coverage. So that's one of the reasons it's golden. And the other reason it's golden is that the Fed has pumped in so much liquidity into the banking system that that money is going to come out and chase assets over the next decade. And I don't know if it does it tomorrow or 14 months from now or 24 months from now, but I know that unprecedented amounts of money exist in banks. It will not all stay there forever. And when it comes out, it's going to chase assets, including multifamily. And that's going to not only allow cap rates to stay steady, I think it's going to push them down over the next decade. And so you've actually got the multiple improving, the cap rate improving, looking forward. That's why I think it's a golden era.
That's very exciting since we're in the multifamily business and we've enjoyed Fannie Mae loans. We have about 40 Fannie Mae loans, many of them in the 2% range, believe it or not, in the twos. Yeah. For 10-year fixed rate money. That is very exciting. It is an extremely liquid market. It's a fluid market. There's lots of capital. No shortage, in part because multifamily is such a large asset class compared to something like medical office, which is relatively small. Apartments are ubiquitous. Housing is ubiquitous.
I think it's interesting that I think it was 1991, something like that. Joe Jerko, a colleague at Wharton, and I did a piece of research. And that research was really trying to point out to institutional capital why they should want to invest in multifamily. Because if you go back, what's that, 30 years ago, showing how old I am, 30 years ago, multifamily was not viewed as an institutional investment class, right? It just wasn't, as strange as that sounds today. And we made some of these points that I just did. They've even gotten better. And as you know, it's an institutional asset these days. And yes, if you buy a 100-unit complex in a tertiary city, that may not be institutional. But all that money that's going after other assets higher up the food chain filter down, right, in their own way. So as you point out, it's quite liquid as a category.
The multifamily asset class is extremely strong and resilient. Is it as simple as housing is a necessity? People need a place to live compared to, say, retail? You don't need a Starbucks coffee, but you need a home.
Well, I don't drink coffee. I've never drank coffee. And every time I go by Starbucks, I don't get it because there are people lined up and waiting. And I figure they must be selling heroin or something because I don't get it. So I'm not sure it's not a necessity, but look, multifamily, or let's take it in general, housing in general is ubiquitous and necessary, whether it's single family rental, multifamily rental, or multifamily ownership. Most people have to live somewhere. Most people prefer over the long run to live on their own, right? I mean, when I say on their own with their own family or by themselves, they will have roommates or live with their parents by necessity. By and large, they want someplace on their own. And in an odd way, you can think of single family ownership, single family renter, multifamily renter, and multifamily ownership as Ford, General Motors, Volkswagen, and Nissan, right? They're four different brands. Each has their own advantages and disadvantages. At any moment in time, one might be doing a little better. But as long as the economy is doing anything like decent, housing performs. It just generally performs because demand is there. And unless supply gets crazy, which I mentioned is hard to do, it's decent. And there are moments when people double up. By the way, we go back to April last year. There was kind of a freeze in the rental market, right? You didn't know if anybody was going to pay their rent. You couldn't get rid of people. You didn't know if anybody was going to want. Everybody was going to go home and live with their parents. And as the economy picks up, you're starting to see the normal dynamics, which is people want their own housing. There's pent-up demand there. We do have this issue of evictions. It's hard to figure out how many of the people behind on their rent, you have a window seat to it, right? How many of the people who are behind on their rent are behaving opportunistically, namely, why pay if I don't have to? And how many of them really need it? And of those who really need it, as you know, there was a tremendous, 40-some billion, I think, was allocated by Congress for this, and only $3 billion has been distributed. So there's plenty of money to help those that need to fill it in. So it's a robust sector.
There's plenty of money out there. Let's use that as a segue to drill down into apartment fundamentals. What happened during the COVID pandemic? And about 15 months ago, Capital Square's HR director told us we had to go home and work from home. We all have laptops. We're all used to traveling. So it wasn't that big a deal. First month's asset management meeting, I asked the asset managers, how are we doing on occupancy? How are we doing on collections? And they said, great, we're 98, 99% rent collected. I said, what do you think will be next month? They said, 98, 99% rent collected. What do you think will be a year from now? 98, 99% rent collected. For 15 months, we've collected about 99% of our rent in spite of COVID. And that told us that real estate was extremely resilient. It's also a function of having Class A and B multifamily, not workforce housing. When COVID hit, our property managers called every tenant, every resident, everyone, 7,000 of them then. We now have 9,000 apartment units. They called and they said, do you need help? And less than 1% said, I need help. The ones that needed help, we worked with. 99%+ didn't need help. They needed a good, clean, safe place to work from home. They needed fast Wi-Fi, and we gave it to them. And we've been collecting 99% of our rent. So Capital Square concluded that was the stress test. We doubled and tripled down on multifamily and began this journey with you talking about things like the migration from the gateway cities. Because yeah, a lot of our apartments are filled with people who used to live in large urban markets who are moving to suburban markets.
California had more seemingly opportunistic not paying rent. I don't know if that's consistent with what you saw, but a bit more opportunistic not paying rent. The rest of the country in the Midwest and South was just amazing, is amazing. And I think your description of it as the stress test is a good one. Right? You kind of, I don't know if it'll be the worst stress test ever, but it was a stress test that was certainly passed.
Let's shift gears a minute and talk about this migration we've been hearing about from the gateway cities. It had been going on for a time, but when COVID hit, why have a $5,000 apartment in Tribeca, New York, when you could have half a house in the Fan District of Richmond, Virginia? Tell us about that migration, if you would.
So I think the key part of the statement is what you said, which is it had already been underway. That Hollywood, if you will, if you go back to 16, 17, 18, probably starting going back to the Friends, right? The TV show Friends, put this gloss on Manhattan and other urban places that everybody was moving there, right? To the urban core. And it was true that more people were living in the urban core than before. But as you know, you still had faster growth happening in the suburbs of those markets And you still had faster growth in the Dallases and Houstons and Atlantas and Richmonds and so forth, right? So that was already underway. It wasn't already publicized, but everybody who knew the data knew it. Then what happened, I think, is partly what you said, and it sped it up a little bit. And that is the only I live in the center of Philadelphia. I've lived here for 40 years. I live two blocks from Independence Hall. And I have to tell you that a year ago, you start saying, why am I living here? I'm living here historically so I can be close to going to the ball game. And if I want to go to a restaurant tonight, I can go. And if I want to go to a theater, I can go, and you know, and so forth.
And they were all closed.
They're all closed.
So why bother?
If you think about it like the scales of justice, you know what I mean? The weighing scales. My view is the urban always had a whole bunch of negatives. Noise, congestions, crime, high taxes, et cetera. It always had negatives, but it always had positives. Like what I was saying, you can go to the ball game, the restaurants, and so forth. And what happened during the pandemic until about 2 or 3 months ago is most all the positives got knocked off the scale and all the negatives are there and even more so, right? Even more so is crime and so forth. Now what's been happening in those urban areas is some of those positives are coming back on the scale. You can go to a restaurant, you can go shopping, you can go to a ball game. So they're not fully back. At the same time, the opposite was happening in the Richmonds and so forth, especially in the suburban areas, right? Which is, I wanted space and they had it. I wanted to be able to go out for a walk without having a bunch of people around me. So the scales got adjusted. Now, the only thing I'd say is the scales are always adjusting. Over your entire career, over my entire career, the scales of different markets and the scales of different submarkets within them constantly are changing. And I think you're still in a period where the urban core is going to struggle a bit for the next couple of years, but it doesn't mean it's dead. But by as you know, we were very bullish on the Nashvilles and Richmond. Richmond's a good example. I just take that because you mentioned it. What is Richmond? Richmond is a poor man's bet on the U.S. government continues to grow. You know, how's that? Because Richmond doesn't have a lot of federal employment. It's a state capital, not a federal capital. But Northern Virginia is driven massively by the federal government, and tax revenues flow to Richmond. And as you know, Richmond has a lot of universities that service Virginia students, many of them out of Northern Virginia. You don't have to go to DC to get some of that dynamics, if you will, of it. And there are other markets like that scattered around the country that are quite attractive.
It's said that state government capitals never have a recession.
Very rarely. And in fact, you know, people point to tech about Austin, right? When you hear people tell the Austin story, it's usually the story of tech and Michael Dell and all this. And I'm not taking anything away from that. But ask yourself, how much would Austin have prospered in the last 20 years, 30 years, if Houston and Dallas and San Antonio populations and economies had been stagnant? The answer is not much. So how did one of the driving forces of Austin was Houston, Dallas, San Antonio booming and siphoning dollars to the state capital to feed their economy? And then you add the state university to feed their economy. You know, people overlook that. State capitals, we published this in Linneman Letter as well. You know, this alpha beta notion, which we went through with you on the report, which is, you think of alpha as, think about the stock market, alpha, beta. Alpha is how much things grow on their own, and beta reflects how much things grow related to the market. Well, we broke down alpha and beta for job growth. How much does a region grow even if the U.S. economy isn't growing? And then how much does it grow if the U.S. economy grows? And so you can imagine we find, not surprisingly, Orlando and Las Vegas, for example, have high betas. When the U.S. economy is really growing, they really, really grow. Because people have discretionary money and they go for vacations and so forth. State capitals at the other end have relatively low betas, but that's because the state employment, state budget stabilizes, right? Which is terrific.
Thank you for joining today's episode of The Real Estate Show, sponsored by Capital Square Realty Advisors. If you would like a copy of Dr. Linneman's white paper, The Golden Age of Multifamily Investing, call or email me at Capital Square Realty Advisors. That's lrogers@capitalsquare1031.com or 877-626-1031. Living in the sweet Virginia
breeze. Sweet Virginia breeze. The Real Estate Show, sponsored by Capital Square Realty Advisors, LLC, is broadcast as an information service and includes opinions as to buying, selling, and holding various investments. However, the host, Lewis Rogers, is not licensed to give any financial, tax, or other investment advice or recommendations. Accordingly, any data and information discussed is provided for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not intended to be an offer or solicitation to invest in any particular investment. You should never make an investment decision based solely off the information discussed on this broadcast. If you are seeking investment, tax, or legal advice, you should consult with a registered investment advisor, financial, tax, or legal professional of your choosing. Opinions and views expressed on this broadcast are opinions and views based on research gathered through what we believe to be reputable sources. Although we believe these sources to be accurate and reliable, in no way do we represent or guarantee the accuracy thereof, nor the accuracy of the statements made on this broadcast. Listeners should independently verify all claims on this broadcast and conduct their own due diligence before investing in any securities or investments, including any mentioned on this broadcast. Investing in securities is highly speculative and carries a high degree of risk.